Tonight's talk will be focused on the Brahma Viharas, four qualities of the mind that are wholesome. Metta, which is loving kindness, Karuna, which is compassion, Mudita, which is sympathetic joy, and Upekkha, which is equanimity. I want to talk about this practice in a way that's integrated with mindfulness of breathing. I've been on several loving kindness retreats over the decades, residential retreats. I've been on many mindfulness retreats. So my practice the last several years has been an attempt to integrate what I call breath body awareness with the cultivated intentionality of the Brahma Viharas. This is in the context of the wisdom aggregate of the Noble Eightfold Path. Wisdom has two elements. One of them is right understanding, which basically involves paying attention to how the selfing story manifests, expectations, so forth and so on, identity. The other function of the wisdom aggregate is right intention, which basically means the intention to be free from dukkha. And in the context of tonight's talk, I want to propose that we can understand the characteristics of dukkha, craving and clinging, from the perspective of the wisdom aggregate. Craving is the feeling tone, felt sense of urgency, emotional reactivity that's associated with experience. Clinging is the identity that comes up in the context of whatever is going on emotionally. So these two functions are interacting. So my view is that right understanding is paying attention to that storyline, and loving kindness, and the subset of loving kindness, a subset of loving kindness, which is compassion and sympathetic joy, are emerging out of loving kindness, all brought into balance by equanimity. One of my aspirations, my guidelines, my understanding of the Dharma over the decades is integrating this ancient wisdom with contemporary psychology and neuroscience. So I want to include that in tonight's discussion to some extent. When we have an experience, the first response set is primarily emotional. Then following on that is the part of the brain that makes meaning. It creates a self is having the experience, and then projects plans, expectations regarding what to do about the experience. Those two things are going on all the time. Mm-hmm. When I went to graduate school back in the mid-80s, I had already been practicing Buddhism for several years, been on retreats and so forth. And I regard Buddhism as a profound psychology, as well as spiritual in its scope. So I wanted to put into play what I had learned from my studies and practice of Buddhism. One of the primary therapeutic modalities in psychotherapy is called cognitive theory, cognitive therapy. And the assumption in the mid 80s about this was what causes a person to be anxious or depressed is a cognitive distortion. There's something about their thought processes that created the anxiety and the depression. And when they just changed their minds, the problem would go away. Way simple, beyond reasonability, actually. But there is some truth in it. The stories we tell ourselves, the selfing story, creates an identity, and that identity struggles to be defended or gratified. It's just the nature of being human. But what caught my attention was the absence of any consideration about feeling, emotions, what's called affect, A-F-F-E-C-T, which is the sort of urgency of an emotion, a feeling either of aversion, rejection of experience, or a feeling of desire, wanting a particular kind of experience. So I was kind of startled by that and tried to talk to my peers about it in graduate school, and they just didn't get it. Well, years later, something emerged called mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. It started to include within it the not just the practice of mindfulness, but also cultivation of loving kindness, self-compassion, which I felt like I was ahead of the curve in that regard. Many people were actually who are now well-established therapists and meditation teachers. So I want to talk more about the integration between mindfulness and loving kindness. You can imagine that the wisdom aggregates like two sides of the same coin. It entails mindfulness, loving kindness, right understanding, right intention. So I want to integrate both of those. Previous to this talk, I led a guided meditation that kind of demonstrates that. It's a meditation practice that I've been using for quite a while. Basically, practicing mindfulness of breathing in the context of maintaining a kind of persistent curiosity about what's going to happen during the in-breath, what's going to happen during the out-breath. Adding into that and a curiosity, a kind of abiding curiosity about what's going on in the middle of my chest. And then introducing a mantra on top of that. Let me say a little bit about mantras. We create ourselves through repetitious narratives. I'm a good person. I'm a bad person. Those can be like mantras. It's one of the characteristics of depression and anxiety, actually, is that kind of repetitive storyline. I'm a loser. I'll never get it right. Nobody really cares about me. These become mantras. Now, part of what happens in these kind of phrasings, any kind of phrasing, is there's typically an emotional memory trace. So, for example, when I say I'm a bad person, those words have some kind of emotional history that gives them potency and seeming validity, because the mind will start to link them together. Here's an example of my losing. Here's an example of my losing. Here's an example. And so that becomes a mantra that has a negative component to it. There's also a positive component to what we say. And so a mantra that has a positive association is part of loving kindness practice. There are many loving kindness mantras. I've taught several over the years. During the guided meditation that just prior to this talk, I used a particular one that's convenient, easy. May I be happy. May I be peaceful. May I be free from suffering, or and free from suffering. Right. So the word happy, it does have an effect on our brains and our bodies. Same with peaceful. Ease of well-being, right? All of those have, they kind of radiate out through this the brain's processing system. Now I want to talk a little bit about the brain's processing system, particularly three areas. There's a cluster of nuclei, of neurons, right in the middle of the brain called the thalamus. It's sort of like a transfer station. Surrounding that, what's called the limbic system. And limbic means on the edge of. Limbic system has to do with our emotional experience. Around that, on the outside, like a shell, just inside the skull, is the cortex. And that's where the memories occur, right? Storyline comes out of that. And lots of different areas are cooperating. So what's going on, I talked about this a few weeks ago, is what's called the hypothalamic loop. What that means is that when a stimulus comes in, the limbic system, the emotional system, checks on it, friend or foe, food or poison, and sends a signal to the thalamus. At the same time, the cortex is trying to make sense out of that feeling tone, that initial reaction. That's going into the thalamus. And they're reverberating back and forth. So all these different areas of the brain are reverberating around each other, out of which emerges a moment of selfing. So I'm trying here to combine what I learned about impermanence and non-self from Buddhist psychology with what I learned as a psychotherapist. So this feedback loop is what builds a sense of self. That loop also extends down into the body. There's an important nerve complex called the vagus nerve. It's the largest nerve in the body. And it's called the vagus nerve because it's when it was first analyzed, it was the understanding of it was vague. Literally, that's why they call it the vagus nerve. It connects, it goes from the base of the brain, connects to the throat, the heart, the lungs, and the intestines. So this vagus nerve provides a communication link between what goes on in the brain and what goes on in the body. Now, during the guided meditation that preceded this talk, I invited people to do what I've done for years, focus on the area between the breastbone and the spine, the middle of your chest. Not out of any sense of curiosity regarding heartbeat. Not at all. I never have noticed it, never cared to. But what I suggested, what I suggest with teaching this, is that you associate or correlate the process of mindfulness of breathing with that area in the body. When you exhale, you kind of breathe down into it. And when you repeat the mantra, you emphasize the phrasing of the mantra with the out-breath. So it's sort of like channeling energy down into that part of the body. Now, this is something that I'm making up as a training protocol. A lot of meditation practices like that, right? But it does associate with what goes on between the thalamus, which also has a connection with the origination of the vagus nerve, down into the body and around the heart, the middle of the chest. One of the things we know about the vagus nerve is that, it connects to the intestines. You ever get a sinking feeling in your stomach or feeling nauseous because something was so shocking? That's the vagus nerve. Did you ever get to a point where you were so emotionally uptight that your throat ached? You couldn't speak? As therapists, I've had interactions with clients over the decades where they couldn't talk like that because they were so re-experiencing a particular trauma in therapy. That's because that's what goes on with the vagus nerve. Research strongly suggests that the practice of mindfulness meditation facilitates the optimal functioning of the vagus nerve. The other thing that's important to understand about it is that there are two different metabolic or hormonal functions associated with the vagus nerve. One of them is the one that energizes the body, the sympathetic system, right? Generates adrenaline and so forth and so on. And the other one is the parasympathetic, which is associated with tranquility. And interestingly enough, with digestion, with a restful digestive process. Once again, vagus nerve, right? So this is how all these different functions in the brain and the body intersect, interact with one another. We can use mindfulness meditation practice associated with intentional repetition of the mantra to kind of change the tone of the vagal process and what we think in our minds. Once again, I want to emphasize that one of the practices, fundamental practices in the four foundations of mindfulness, is mindfulness of the body. In terms of the way the limbs are arranged, the physical experience of breathing in and breathing out, any sense of temperature or pressure, all of those things, mindfulness of the body. Mindfulness of feelings is very much associated with loving kindness. Feelings have a strong connection with intentions, which are actually part of the fourth foundation of mindfulness. But in the context of this, the reactivity that we are exposed to, that we experience routinely, can be balanced. So there's an optimal intersection between, or interaction between, the sympathetic and parasympathetic systems. That's what equanimity is, actually, functionally. That's all mediated through the vagus nerve, and it all happens in the intersection or the interaction between how the mind is organizing experience and what's going on in the body. Right? That's really what loving kindness practice is about. It's learning how to change the feeling tone and the level of consciousness. That's the third foundation of mindfulness, mindfulness of consciousness, mindfulness of the mind. And it has to do with feeling tone. It has things to do with ability to pay attention and so forth and so on. But it has to do with that balance between the sympathetic and parasympathetic. Because when that's going on, the ability of the mind to function is effectively in a kind of the process of awakening is enhanced, right? So what goes on with this practice in terms of loving kindness is that our ability to manage interpersonal conflict is effectively enhanced. One of the signs of what's called emotional intelligence is the ability to stay emotionally balanced in conflict and be effective at negotiating, right? That has a lot to do with our relationships in our lives, right? We get to practice that. But using the loving kindness practice enhances that social skill. Now, as I mentioned earlier, I've been on several loving kindness residential retreats. Each one lasted a week. One of the things that I noticed is that when I started out the retreat, I was really focusing on the mantra and the breath. And then I noticed after a while, instead of me needing to say, may I be safe, the word safe would happen on the out-breath. Happy. Ease of well-being. I was using another mantra at the time, but that's not relevant to this talk tonight. But what would go on after several days of that, I wouldn't even need to use those words at all. Every time I breathed out, this feeling of expansion, of buoyancy, of peacefulness and stability seemed to fill up my body. Once again, this is metaphorical. It's just a way to practice. It felt like I was breathing kindness into my heart. And with every breath, it was expanding out into my body, out to the tips of my fingers and my toes. Right? So it was this really wonderful feeling of stability and clarity and peacefulness. So that's how the practice can progress when you, you know, immerse yourself into a retreat experience. So during my research for this talk, I checked with Google's famous AI about the etymology and functioning of loving kindness. This is what I found. Metta in Pali is derived from the Sanskrit word maitri, both of which translate to loving kindness, goodwill, or friendliness. The etymology traces back to the word mita in Sanskrit mitra, which fundamentally means friend in ancient Indian Vedic texts. Mitra also carried the root meaning of contract, pact, or alliance. This origin highlights several key nuances of the term, the root of friendship. Metta is not a romantic or possessive attachment. Rather, it is the extension of boundless, unselfish friendship and goodwill to all beings, without discrimination or expectation of return. In spiritual relationship companionship, it is closely related to the phrase kalyanamitta. Again, there's that word mitta, which translates to spiritual friend or noble friend, a foundational concept in Buddhist practice referring to a mentor or guide who supports your awakening. The action of kindness. Some Pali commentators break down the term further to mean an active softening of the heart, almost like becoming fat with friendliness. When I read that and say that, I'm remembering what it felt like to breathe into loving kindness into my body. And when I say breathe it into my body, I'm not talking about something metaphysical. It's just a practice strategy, right? I think that's important to understand. Now, in all of the Brahma Viharas, there are what are called the near enemy and the far enemy. The near enemy is kind of the opposite, the main conflicted opposite. For loving kindness, the near enemy is attachment, idealization. An example I have in my notes, when I did my first retreat, it was really hard. It was in April in 1982, and it was in Massachusetts, and it was cold. And I was, you know, just a beginner. My very first retreat went on for 10 days. I just made a determination that I was going to do whatever they wanted me to do to the best of my ability. I'd studied up, I practiced meditating, so forth and so on. But it was hard. At the end of the retreat, somebody came up to me and said, "You are such a wonderful meditator, so peaceful. Wow, you did that so well." And that did not match up with my subjective experience, right? Now, what my assumption is, this person was projecting something onto me, but what they were noticing was my intentional commitment to this training. I did not back off. I was there for every sitting. I just did everything they asked me to do, and it was obvious. So that's interesting. That person idealized me as the perfect meditator, right? That's it's called a Vipassana romance, right? Then there's the opposite, the Vipassana vendetta. I don't really have an example of that because I didn't really struggle with that very much. But basically, it's the same kind of idealization, except it creates another person's flaws, makes them outstanding, defining that person. They're a terrible person. They're a terrible meditator, or they're horribly greedy or something like that. So that kind of projection can be involved with all of the Brahma Viharas. Just very briefly, the near enemy of compassion is pity. Compassion does not involve lessening another person, and pity lessens the other person. The far enemy of compassion is harshness and cruelty. With mudita, sympathetic joy, the near enemy is idealization. You pretend to really want to be generous and supportive of another person's success, but you're pretending, right? The far enemy is jealousy and envy. With upekkha, equanimity, the near enemy is shutting down, just kind of blocking feeling about whatever. That's not what this practice is about. This practice is about being aware of feelings as they occur without any resistance, understanding them in the context of wisdom. Right understanding or right intention. The far enemy of equanimity is attachment. Is once again is a certain kind of idealizing of loving kindness or of permanence, so forth and so on. So that's kind of an overview of the experience, the practice. Let me see here. So in practicing, I'm in the notes here, I have some suggestions, some bullet points. First of all, recognize the emotional tone of a loving kindness mantra. I mentioned this earlier. Words such as safe, happy, healthy, and content all have positive emotional memories associated with them. It basically, typically has a history of not feeling threatened. Right? So often what goes on for us in our lives, but also in our meditation practice, the mind will feel threatened and start to contract and become defensive and lose its balance and kindness, becomes rigid. So using these words has that kind of beneficial effect. Another bullet point, coordinate the pattern of normal breathing with the loving kindness mantra. And once again, I want to emphasize that there's what's called behavioral linking. Psychology. It has to do with establishing certain routines associated with certain circumstances, doing it over and over again. The simile that I've used is that if you're a basketball player and your weakest shot is a hook shot, you don't wait till you're middle of a game when somebody's in your face to practice doing the hook shot. You go out on the court by yourself and you just keep going through the motions, right? Being on the court, seeing the basket, holding the ball, moving your arms, maybe wearing the same kind of shoes or whatever, but you establish a particular kind of a set of reference points and you practice from that. That's what the mantra is about. That's what the protocol is about. It's what mindfulness breathing is about. But when you start to make those associations, let me do another example here. After a 1 week retreat out in Taos, New Mexico, as a matter of fact, when I came back from that retreat, my primary practice for months was loving kindness. So I would mow the lawn with loving kindness. I would drive the car with loving kindness. You know, I would do all these different behaviors with that as part of the setup, the way I was going to live my life. And then it kind of faded out, which happens, you know. But I'm sure it left a trace in my brain and my body that's useful to this day. This was probably 30 years ago when I was on that retreat. So this one I have to say about general overview of the Brahma Viharas. They're meant to be qualities of the mind that are supportive of awakening. Mindfulness supports loving kindness. Loving kindness supports mindfulness. Mindfulness and loving kindness support compassion, which is going to be talked about, I think, next week. And loving kindness also, another manifestation of that is sympathetic joy, which is, in my mind, is very similar or associated with generosity. It's celebrating the success and happiness of another being. It might not even be human. It might be, you know, freeing a butterfly from spider web, petting your dog, you know, mindfully. That kind of practice is what we're trying to cultivate, is the ability to develop this system of relating to life experience, particularly in relationships, that's supported by a desire to be kind and compassionate. Now, in terms of the fourth of the Brahma Viharas, Upekkha, equanimity, basically provides the balance so that these particular qualities don't fall into the far enemy or the near enemy, right? That's what Upekkha is all about. And mindfulness and investigation of mental phenomena and right effort. First three of the seven awakening factors. Okay, so that's my explanation of this. I've really enjoyed thinking about this freshly, and I'm open to any questions or comments from those participating. Nobody, huh?
No.
Okay, Satish.
So what you talked about on the physical aspects, how does this relate to spirituality? Or does all this, is it all spirit? Is it what spirituality is, or how does it connect to spirituality?
Buddhism is interesting in that the other major paths, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, they all have some kind of reference to a higher power, an other being, Allah, God, so forth and so on. Buddhism doesn't pay attention to that. Buddhism pays attention to how to relieve the mind from distress and confusion, from craving and clinging. It does not, Buddhism does not deny a God. It just says that the more you focus on that, the less likely it is you're actually to experience spiritual awakening. So Buddhism is a practice of living that leads to spiritual benefit for oneself and the world without using any kind of external savior kind of or you know, God concept.
Is that basically the practice that you talked about?
Yeah, wisdom. Wisdom is the higher power of Buddhism. And then right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration are all supportive of that. Actually, there's an analysis of the Eightfold Path that talks about shifting it, maturing of the Eightfold Path into the Tenfold Path. And in that case, wisdom changes. When all the other supportive factors are developed to their greatest potential, right understanding becomes right knowledge. Right understanding is conceptual. Right knowledge is, you know it. It's confirmed in your own experience. Right intention becomes right liberation. The mind is freed from needing to defend or gratify an identity. Doesn't mean you can't function, but your function is more organized around, or almost entirely organized around, kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and balance.
So in context of Buddhism, I've heard emptiness.
Mm-hmm.
Does that fit in with this?
Emptiness basically means that it's empty of the notion that there's an enduring autonomous self. The word empty is troublesome, right? I prefer to think of it as open or unconstrained. The whole notion of emptiness is not nihilistic. It's not, in any way negative. It just basically means we can change our mind either for the better or for the worse. It really depends on the training, the path.
So would it be correct to say that this is like a person in the central focus of this practice or not?
Make it a central focus of your practice.
Yeah.
The cultivation of wisdom is the central focus of the practice. I'm just focusing tonight on loving kindness, right intention. But, when we were talking about the seven awakening factors, that's the part of wisdom that's associated with right understanding. The more we can cultivate an integration between right understanding, right intention, between mindfulness and loving kindness, the more we can fulfill the potential of the Eightfold Path, and that's how it becomes the Tenfold Path.
It requires a lot of doing on the part of the person.
More practice is necessary. Okay. You've heard me say that many times.
What?
You've heard me say that many times, yeah. Right? More practice is necessary.
Yeah, practice is necessary.
Yeah. Good questions. Thank you. Any other? Yes. Yeah. Christy's here. Yes.
Can you talk about the emotional aspect of loving kindness practice? I mean, I've read that it's not necessary to have an emotional response to what you're the concentrating on, and a lot of times the loving kindness practice that I've heard about and practiced is directed at someone. You
yeah.
direct it to a mentor, you direct it to a loved one,
yes.
you direct it to yourself.
Right.
And a lot of people have trouble with the directing at yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard that it is not necessary to have the reaction, an emotional reaction of loving towards that person or yourself. I just wondered if you could talk about that, because sometimes you do it and I don't feel any emotional response at all. I mean, I feel physical things, I feel feeling tones, that sort of thing, but I don't suddenly feel like running out and, you know, kissing the trees or whatever. So can you talk about that at all?
Sure.
Is it just not effective when I'm doing
it? Yeah, the guided meditation that preceded this talk was not one that I typically do. There's several that I've recorded that are posted on the website and the archives. But they follow that progression. You start with yourself and you focus that, you kind of radiate that out. You imagine sending it to someone who you admire, someone who you do not regard as troubled, right? Then the next layer, there are people who are in your life. And they might be person at the checkout, you know, the clerk at the checkout line, the supermarket. It might be a neighbor, coworker. But that relationship, instead of it being organized around an idealized person, it's sort of like an everyday experience of relationship. Then the progression moves to someone with whom you have an adversarial or conflicted relationship, whether they're actually alive or not. So you wish that person to be happy and peaceful with an ease of well-being, right? And work with that, because the mind is going to want to resist it, right? Then the next level of progression is all beings, great and small, near and far. Creatures that fly, creatures that swim, creatures that crawl, creatures that walk, so forth and so on. All beings. Now, this is not meant, in my view, to change the world, but it changes my attitude, my relationship to the world. For example, maybe I have a conflicted relationship with a family member. Right. And I don't spend any time with that person anymore. But I might encounter someone who reminds me somehow of that relative. And because of the things I was saying about the associations that go on emotionally with words, they go on with visual stimuli as well. So I might feel some fear or hostility regarding that other person who I may not know at all. Right. But somehow or other, I get stirred up by that. I can bring kindness to that so that I do not inflict any suffering, any pain on that other person. Right. Or if I encounter that relative who is hurtful, dangerous, my experience of relating to them is different. I'm less defensive, more balanced, more capable of having compassion, because the reason why that person's a jerk is because of how that person was traumatized, injured, and acted that out on me, right? So I can bring a different perspective to negotiating that relationship. And that's another way that this practice progresses. There's another form of the metta, which means, may I be safe, et cetera, kind of establishing that as a foundational point and expanding that out into the room. May all beings in this room be happy and peaceful with an ease of well-being. Then outside this room, right, in the neighborhood, including animals, right? And then out into the Central Florida area, and then to all beings, right? So it's the same kind of build out, so to speak, starting with your own heart, your own ability to recognize the reactivity inside and manage it from a perspective of the Brahma-Viharas rather than craving and clinging. That help clarify it?
Well, it answers a question that I wasn't asking. I mean, it's all informative, but I was talking about the sense of what you feel as you're doing loving kindness.
Oh, okay. Well, I described it.
Should you feel loving towards whoever you are?
That's not how it works.
Okay.
There's a feeling of openness and warmth and connection. I was talking about breathing it into my body, so it feels more and more expansive and inclusive. Okay. Now, when I was on that retreat in Taos, when I left Orlando to go there, I knew of someone I was close to who I had a falling out with was dying from cancer. And I practiced, and suddenly it occurred to me about halfway through the retreat that this person probably is dead, because it was really endgame for that person. Instead of any feeling of anger or remorse or even sadness, there was this sense of, I really enjoyed relating to this person. Had a falling out, but there's a sense of caring. Along with that came compassion. I had the same attitude about my parents. My parents were not very successful at parenting me. They split up when I was 12, 13 years old. I lived by myself after that. So I had a lot of unfinished business with them. But with my practice, there's a much gentler, much deeper understanding of the human condition, reflecting back on their inadequacies. Somehow or other, I managed to turn it around and have a good life rather than a miserable life. But I attribute a lot of that to my practice. I might feel an emotion like fear or anger, but there's a softness about that awareness. It's not fearful. It's not overwhelming. But I know that I'm angry. It's very closely associated with what happens when your mindfulness practice advances and you start to cultivate viraga. You've heard me talk about this before. Viraga is dispassion. It doesn't mean numbness. What it means is that I might be aware of something. And as I'm saying this, I'll use an example. I was on a retreat right here years ago, and I had an episode of kidney stones right in the middle of it. And I woke up, and my side hurt. I'd had them before. I knew what was going on, but because I was in the retreat, this wasn't a loving kindness retreat. This was a mindfulness meditation retreat. My body was writhing in pain, but my mind was very calm and peaceful and interested in what was going on. Look what a body does when its kidney stone is happening. So my body was really writhing. My mind was calm and alert, right? So that is kindness and compassion in action. Because I could have gotten all wrapped around. Well, like earlier in my life, I did get all wrapped around having a kidney stone episode. But now it's different. Does that clarify it? I might feel joy to the point of tears, but it comes from a different place. It's not like something outside is making me joyful. It's that the quality of the mind is joyful. Any questions or comments from the Zoom crew?
Excuse me, my name's John. I can't go without commenting and telling you that I really enjoyed the meditation. I like the idea of it being a protocol, you know, the kind of a routine. I'm reading Wes Nisker's Being Nature, and a lot of what you said tonight is I've been reading about. It's you know, to the evolutionary. Neurology and stuff is fascinating, and I just wanted to say thank you. So thank you.
You're welcome. I think that's one of the most important things about Buddhism in the West is that these brilliant, transformative insights and practices that were cultivated thousands of years ago by the world of Buddhism and of Hinduism, which places great emphasis on meditation. A lot of it is burdened by cultural things that were going on during those developmental phases. Well, we have a cultural thing going on. It's called science, psychology, and it's being brought to the investigation of the mind, accompanied by mindfulness. So there are a lot of researchers who are inspired by Buddhism and integrating neuroscience with psychology, Buddhism. And kind of in closing, I want to tell a story about a fellow named Richie Davidson. This was from a book called Altered Traits. It's about the integration of Buddhism and neuroscience. Richie Davidson was a dedicated meditator, but also has a PhD in psychology. In neuroscience, actually. He was at a conference, an international conference with the Dalai Lama. And he heard somebody ask a question. He was talking to the Dalai Lama himself. And he was talking about how they were using very sophisticated scientific research things, functional MRI device, to investigate depression. You know, what goes on in the brain when someone's depressed? It turns out that the right preorbital lobe is dominant when someone's depressed. So he was talking to the Dalai Lama about this because it's associated with dukkha. And the Dalai Lama said something almost offhand. Well, have you ever considered studying what makes people happy? And it just like a light went off in Richie Davidson's mind. He started researching what makes someone happy, what goes on in the brain, right? He investigated several meditation masters and discovered that when someone is really concentrated, the left preorbital lobe is dominant, all lighted up, hyperactive, and started to understand how happiness is conditioned in the brain. Very important transformation thing. And I think that had a lot to do with the transition of mindfulness-based cognitive therapy away from just change your mind to change your mind and cultivate kindness for yourself. So that's the end of our talk for tonight. Next week, I believe, Ali is going to talk about compassion. I think so. Let me see here. Yes, on June the 10th. It's our custom at the end of our meetings to sit together in silence briefly. So let's do that. Thank you for your practice. I wish you well. I hope we're all reasonably safe and happy. Till the next time we have a chance to chat.